Welcome to the Powder Keg Podcast, the show that plugs you into the massive opportunities in startups and tech beyond Silicon Valley that are exploding with potential. I'm your host, Matt Hunkler, and I have a special co-host joining me today, Nate Spangle, our new head of community at Powder Keg. Nate, say hello.
Hello, hello. Excited.
All right, let's do this. I'm really excited because today I've got two friends in the studio who have been a part of the Powder Keg community since before it was the Powder Keg community. The two co-founders of Lessonly, who have just done an amazing job growing an awesome team, recently acquired by Seismic, based here in Indianapolis, Indiana, where we are recording out of 76 Forward, the new tech hub right in the middle of downtown Indianapolis at 16 Tech. Max, Connor, super happy to have you here today. Thanks for being here.
Sweet spot.
Yeah, amazing. Right?
Good to be amazing. Here.
It's pretty crazy. Pretty crazy. We are super grateful to have a nice studio set up and have plenty of space to talk tech, talk passion, talk learning.
Yeah, let's talk passion.
I like all the things. All right, let's start with passion. So, Max, Connor, for our listeners, just for a little context, we've all known each other, I think, a decade now, which is crazy. All four of us in this room right now, including Nate, are part of the OR Fellowship program, an entrepreneurial fellowship based in Indiana. So I knew you guys way back when, even before Lessonly was an idea.
Right.
Which is a really cool perspective to have on things. But I'd love to get your perspective on just the early days. Max, when you were just starting Lessonly, can you give us some context of where you were in your life and what was driving you just in terms of your passion?
I was winding down my first attempt at a business called Quipple. And there was an overlap in there of Quipple winding down, Lessonly winding up. Connor and I are roommates. So he's kind of seeing my decay, my kind of spirit decay. My spirit decays as, you know, sure. Quipple goes down. Sure. All my friends know about it. All my family members know about it. And it's not working. It's just not going in anywhere that gives any sign that this is a thing that is going to work. My only chance I feel like is to do Justin Bieber and Kim Kardashian polls. Because it was polling software.
Yep.
And I was like, the only thing that seems to get attention is like stuff I don't want to engage in at all. Yeah. Like my spirit is not there.
Yeah.
So I'm winding that down. And Christian Anderson, Mike Fitzgerald, Eric Tobias, they've talked about, they've had a lot of business ideas floating around. And the one that ultimately we landed on was training software, but we didn't really know for whom. So when Connor and I are living together, kind of sussing out which direction. I'll let you tell the story of where you took Lessonly for the first time to really test it out and really changed our trajectory.
Yeah, and Connor, you had an exact target at the time, is that right?
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
Got acquired later by Salesforce.
Yes.
So probably biggest software company in Indianapolis and Indiana at the time.
Yeah, in a span of a year, it was a 50-person startup called IGO Digital that became exact target that became Salesforce. As we got bigger and bigger, I realized the fit for me was not the right one, but serendipitously, as Max was describing, he's kind of tinkering around with training software. He's kind of built, I'd call it an MVP. Mm-hmm. There was software there, but there wasn't much.
Right.
And, you know, my job through these acquisitions essentially became training. I was doing sales, but one of the things in an acquisition you learn pretty quick is the only way you unlock the value of the acquisition is to enable the bigger sales force. So 50-person startup, all of a sudden we got to teach 1,000 exact target reps how to go sell exact this new product they have. And so my job essentially became be a worldwide trainer. I went to Australia, London, and at the time Max was working on this early idea for Lessonly and just said, hey, can I try this out? Like, I literally am going to do training, and they literally, their strategy is to send me, a 23-year-old, they're a multinational global company, and they're sending me, a 23-year-old, to train these really important sales reps. And I thought, man, if Salesforce can't figure this out, there's probably something here. And I'd say we both were naive to the market. We didn't know a whole lot about the space, but it was enough to say, like, a couple customers paying us and a big company seems to need this. Like, let's see what happens.
Yeah, Salesforce never became a customer. But no. but Connor used it as a Salesforce employee, you know, and, yeah. and it worked, right? You flew to Australia and got there, gosh. And people already knew what you needed them to know.
Yeah, the funniest part about it was, I think they sent me there for a month. Like, I had a sweet gig. I was in Sydney, 23, sweet hotel, all expensive paid. And in about a week, I was like, I think my job's done here, because I had sent them all these lessons. Everybody had been trained, and I got there, and they're just like, hey, help me sell these deals, not teach me how to do this. So I was like, I'd say this worked. I was just kind of sitting there enjoying Australia, and then off we went. Yeah.
Yeah. And then, yeah, first customer, second customer, third customer, ninth customer, and now we're here. One customer at a time.
One
that's awesome.
Hard-fought customer at a time.
So I didn't realize that Salesforce wasn't a customer. They were just a user.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Probably
that's broke super
some
valuable.
Protocols.
And oh, no doubt
some
you
security.
Did. No doubt.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And all that.
For sure. For sure.
I hope they don't fire you.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a good way to road test it. That's awesome. So tell me a little bit about the idea to join forces and really go after this. So Max, Connor, like I think of you two as very much yin and yang, very complementary skill sets. Did you get that right off the bat when you were looking at working together, or were you kind of looking to fill a specific need, Max and Connor, were you looking for something that was kind of a little bit more startup again?
I know how I'd describe it. I'm curious how you would.
I definitely knew from the jump we were very different. Yep. You know, I love sports, Max loves music. So you take anything we do, like it's pretty, we're opposite sides of the coin in a lot of ways. But I think fundamentally, we just always got along. I mean, we moved in as roommates, like not really knowing each other and just quickly connected. And I think Max is super good at just being open and vulnerable and pursuing people, as you've probably felt, Matt. And I was one of those people. So I felt like, this guy, he's probably the best friend I have in the shortest amount of time. You know, it takes a long time to build a friendship, but I evaluated it like, this guy is really investing in me, and I feel like we're great friends in a matter of months, you know, which was a cool feeling. And then, you know, when we looked at our skill sets on paper, Max loved product and culture, and I had experience in go-to-market. So, like, all of our skill sets were basically the opposite. And then I think as the company evolved, I would say Max really brought the heart and the soul of the culture. I brought a little bit more of the drive and the competitiveness and how are we going to play this big game and win this space. And the two together, I'm not sure we could have done it because neither of us have the opposite skill set.
Yeah, I think that's right. I do think that the myth is that I brought the culture and the spirit, but that's a myth. You brought your own parts of that culture and spirit that I revere, you know, like that I am like, oh, I wouldn't have done it that way, but I'm so glad you do it that way. Corey Keim did the same. Mitch Causey did the same. Yep. Mike Wendell did the same. Evan and then Carly and like so on and so forth. I think we brought openness to like, hey, if it's collaborative and if it is, you know, loving and supportive and creative and creativity inducing, we're all for it. And that kind of open spirit. But like, let's say you come in and like, if the myth is to believe if I bring the culture, if you would have brought a kind of classic sales, classic is maybe the wrong term, what people think of when they think of sales.
Stereotypical.
Yeah, stereotypical. Yeah. Hard driving, kind of hard nosed. Like, but that's never what you brought.
Right.
You brought a very thoughtful approach to sales, which is just like, let's be genuine with people who, if they want it, great, we'll give it to them. If they don't want it, that's okay. You know, we won't shove it down your throats, but we'll believe in what we sell. You know, so if we see an opportunity to help somebody, we're not just going to be like, we're not just going to walk away. You know what I mean? Like you pursued people,
right,
who you thought you could help,
100%,
but didn't shove it down their throats. Yeah. Right. And that changes the whole business. Cause we ended up being a sales driven culture. As much as I wish I could say we were a product driven culture, I've always struggled to keep the product where I needed it to be.
Why do you think that is?
I just think probably lack of experience. I think I probably would just start building product differently. Didn't cut losses on kind of paths when we should have, you know, like just not knowing what to do because I'd never done it before.
I also think, to be fair, it was a resourcing thing too. As you know, in our 9 years ago, startup environment was less prolific in fundraising. We weren't we didn't always put as huge amounts of money on the balance sheet. And so, you know, the kind of business equation became, well, we could hire into sales and we can see and logically see how this is going to return something and how it helps us not run out of money. Whereas hiring 5 more engineers, obviously that's a smart long-term bet, but it's harder to see how that's going to not help us not run out of money. And we eventually got there towards the very end.
Right at the very end. Yeah. Yeah.
We came up with it was called our product and engineering stimulus bill, just aggressive hiring at the very last 6 months.
Yeah. Yeah. And like getting the right product management ratio and designer ratio to engineers, like things that, you know, if we invested in the product, we always put more into engineering than we did the product marketing and product design side. And so just all the stuff we just didn't know,
You
know? And so that was, so we ended up being, you know, I think a sales led culture that was very, you know, product oriented and cultural oriented. But yeah, I think the myth is that one person does that. And I just don't think that's true. And, you know, I think another thing to point out that I find to be very important is Corey Keim, Mitch Causey join us. Mitch kind of would run when like as fast as Connor and I did, but Corey was always asked questions before we started running. So it became like this really clear, it wasn't just a yin yang thing. It was like, this is an ensemble. Different people bring different vibes.
Yep.
And because we're open enough to respect one another's vibes and to not think we're the smartest person in the room, people show up and they ask the questions that are on their mind and we get smarter as a result. You know, so Corey would be like, hey, that's a really nice idea. And I can see you all are very fired up about it. You know, he would not be condescending. He would just be like, yeah. Hey, interesting. I have a few questions. And then as he asked those questions, he'd be like, oh, we have not given this so much thought. Right.
You know, well, I would like to dig in more on that dynamic too, because I think Corey is one of those like unsung heroes of Leslie's early success.
Yes.
But also, Nate, feel free to jump in here if you've got questions. You know, entrepreneur yourself, Nate, I know you've done your own startups. And so feel free to jump in when you've got questions, man.
Of course. Yeah.
So, Corey, interesting third leg of the stool early on and brought a really interesting dynamic when you think about. Culture comes from the top. It's it's you, Max, but it's also you, Connor. It's also Corey. And of course, it's everyone on the team following the lead of the three of you. Talk to me a little bit more about how Corey's energy helped balance you two out in those early days.
Yeah, I'll just say for me, him and Connor are very steady. Well, I see myself to be kind of emotional swings. You know, things are going well. I kind of ride the highs and I dive into the lows, you know, like just a lot less emotional stability. And I found that him and Connor brought a lot of emotional stability.
Yeah.
Like something would hit the fan and they would both approach it as like, okay. And I'd be like, oh no. You know? and that's a great thing to have, right? It's people who just kind of are calm.
Yeah.
And so Corey has always been calm. And, you know, he led our client experience kind of post-sales team from the first person to be hired from it was him. And the person to run it all the way to the acquisition is him. And that team just got bigger and bigger and more multifaceted. And he scaled across the board, you know, and did it in a very steady way. So steadiness is what I bring from Corey. And then, you know, inquisitiveness, the value of asking clarifying questions is a value that I ascribe to kind of his. I saw him do that so much and saw the value of it because of him.
Yeah.
You know, I learned it from him.
I also think the skill set he brought at the time, you know, he led all of our post-sales work, but he also played a very important role in shaping the product. Like he never had a formal product title, but I imagine we could have veered so far off course without him because we had this, you know, kind of natural constraint. We had two 20-hour a week engineers first. That was our only engineering firepower. So we spent way more time debating what should be built before we actually built something because we just couldn't. And Corey was always the person to make sure we didn't invest too much in one direction or another where Max and I might have full conviction because I talked to a prospect or Max just liked the idea and liked the design of it. Corey was very practical about we're in a resource constrained world. Let's make the most of it. And as Max said, let's make sure we listen to customers and interpret that and put it into patterns we can use.
Pattern recognition. Yeah. And he was very good at not going for the flash. Like if it helped us in the flash kind of early sale, he was not impressed. Because he's like, I have customers who, while that's nice in the early sale, like it doesn't necessarily translate into value. That's a balance, right? Like something that kind of pumps somebody up. But then he's like, I got the customers over here who need this feature that is not sexy at all, but they need it. It's making it harder for us to do our jobs. And so his consistency and able to do that for 9 years when we never learned a lesson.
Not never.
Like never learned these lessons of like, oh yeah, we have to invest that, you know, equally on both sides. The fact that he stuck around is a wonder because he was consistent in what he asked for and didn't always, you know, we weren't always as thoughtful as we probably could have been. We were kids.
I mean, we all are at heart.
Yeah. I still want to be a kid.
Yeah.
I just want to learn from my experiences.
Did it feel like that kind of energy early on? Like it was kind of a playground or did you feel like you were taking it pretty seriously because this was your second startup and you really wanted it to work?
It was not a playground for me.
Yeah.
No, it was very, I really stressed until very recently.
What changed?
Well, we sold the business.
Okay. Like very, very recently.
Yeah. I mean, I knew 2 years ago that it wasn't going to just disappear overnight.
Sure.
But it took 7 years to really have it won't.
Yeah.
You know, like for the first 7 years, I was like, what if somebody comes out with something that's free and they're good and it's good, you know, and they can sell it as a loss leader. You know, and just kind of cripple us.
Yeah.
That was always my fear is that, you know, Google was going to come out with something beautiful in the training space and they were going to not need to really sell it because that's not where they make their money. And that fear carried for a long time. So in the year seven, we closed our first seven-figure deal. The business was on fire. I mean, at this point, we are stacking, you know, a $10 million on top of $10 million. And it's like, oh my gosh, this is a pretty big business, you know? So that's when I was like, it's probably not going to go away. But until we joined forces with Seismic, I felt like I was always had this lingering fear in the back of my head of the reason why we wanted to join forces with Seismic in a big way was we needed to be able to keep competing. Yep. Right. And we had been this independent entity for almost a decade.
Sure.
Selling pretty much one thing the whole time. And Seismic now brings us a whole new arsenal of things that we pair them together. And I have no doubt we're going to do very well together. You know, so that was when I was like, whew, you know, there. But it did not feel like a playground. And I wish it would have, but like, we can't rewrite history. It feels I'm having more creative expression now and fun now.
You know? Sure. Sure.
A little looser now.
How about you, Connor? How are you feeling during those early days?
Very similar. I think it felt amongst the two of us and Corey and Mitch, like we got a lot to prove is what it always felt like. We're kind of young, felt like probably didn't deserve an opportunity like this at age 24. It's a competitive market. It just felt like there was always something to prove. Mm-hmm. And even when we hit the next milestone, 1 million in revenue, 100 customers, 1,000 customers, it always felt like there was some foundation of sand somewhere that could crumble.
Yeah.
And especially because if you think about the 9-year arc, we benefited a ton from just this up and to the right economy. Businesses are doing well. You know, we had a ton of luck in that way. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, software was getting this premium valuation on purely growth, right? Yeah. And we were never like, we were always a high growing business that was really capital efficient, not a top 1% growing business that wasn't capital efficient. And all of a sudden, the way software businesses were viewed became through this lens of growth. So what became very clear, even as we got bigger, was, yeah, we're not going to disappear overnight. But if we're in 25 million, not pretty quickly getting to 50, the enterprise value of this company that we've worked for 9 years to build is going to plummet. And that means everyone who owns stock in the company, which is everybody, all 250 people at Lessonly, don't get to a finish line and a win that we all wanted. So it just never felt like a playground.
Yeah, because we had to multiply. I mean, our growth had to be 50% year over year, 75% year over year, you know, and depending. Yeah. And it was, yeah, like Connor said, if we were going 10% year over year at a $50 million company, we never got there, right? We joined forces like before we hit 50 mil, but we were going 25 to 50. And if we were going 10% year over year as a $50 million company, we don't get much of a premium on our valuation, right?
Right.
Let's say we get a 5X.
Yep.
Okay. So that's $250 million business.
Yep.
You know, as a $25 million business, if we're going like we were 76%, we get a 10X. So we're already at that valuation that we 2 years earlier, right?
Yeah.
And so it's almost a big risk kind of continuing to go.
Sure.
If our growth rate doesn't stay, and it's not easy to keep that growth rate up because the base is getting bigger. You know, it's like, oh, just, I'm so, it's nonstop.
Well, it's interesting too, because when I think about Lessonly, I think of it as kind of a quintessential Midwest startup tech company story, you know, in that sense, not raising the huge mega rounds that you're seeing on TechCrunch in the Bay Area and New York, more so in the middle of the country now, certainly than 10 years ago.
Chicago raised big rounds.
Chicago raising big rounds. Even here, I mean,
you know, right.
Meta CX raised a huge round before they even had a product or a customer.
Yep.
There's obviously been a big cultural shift. But in terms of the culture of Lessonly, do you think it would have been more stressful or less stressful with more capital?
Probably a yin yang thing, right? In some spots it would have been more painful, in other spots it would have been went more wind at our back. I wouldn't do it any differently, you know, because we got to where we needed to go. Like I'll be really quick on this, but we were going to raise $3 million in our Series A and ended up raising $5 million.
Mm.
And because OpenView Venture Partners, who ended up doing our A and our B round, great, great firm. Gosh, couldn't love them more. We're like, hey, you're the earliest in revenue we've ever invested in a company. And $3 million is not, we can't put enough into the business if you only raise three.
Mm.
So would you potentially raise $5 million? Which to us, we were like, well, that's almost twice as much. That's a little scary, you know? What a big difference it made though to raise $5 million. We ended up being able to hire people who we wouldn't have been able to afford, who are still with the business today, who made dramatic impacts on the business. We ended up being able to make investments that we wouldn't have been able to make. And it was only because they asked us to take a couple more $1 million, you know, like we had no plans to raise $5 million. It was like, they got the term sheet and they're like, but only way we do the term sheet is you raise two more. How lucky was that?
Oh, so lucky.
How lucky was that? So who the heck knows, you know, what would have been right or wrong? It just would have been a different permutation.
For those who, whether they're a founder or co-founder or even just an early employee at a startup, What are some of the things that you've learned over this journey with Lessonly in terms of managing stress, in terms of getting that state of flow and maybe not riding the wave quite so much? I shouldn't say riding the wave, but getting pulled under by the undercurrents.
Sure.
Yeah, I think one is a bit of a paradox, which is you have to be maniacally focused on results, but at the same time, you have to let those go. Like short-term results this quarter are not going to break or make or break the business. And so I think you have to find a way to get yourself out of that in those early stages where it feels like there's so much pressure and it feels like the business is going to die if we don't hit this quarter. But you've got to find a way to think beyond that horizon and say, let's fight for these results. Let's bring some excellence to the way we operate this business. But at the same time, if we fall a little bit short this quarter, let's look 12 months from now and are we making the right investments? That's been a hard, something we never did, but I wish we would have had that mentality. I think we would have made different decisions along the way, perhaps. And if we approached it maybe more like a playground or an art form and said, what do we want this to be long-term? As opposed to what do we want this to be in the next 90 days? We never really got out of that cycle, in my opinion.
No, I'm with you. And I just don't know. I don't know if I could have gotten there when it's the only thing I've ever really built that brings kind of value. You know, this is my whole net worth is in this business, right? Mm-hmm. And the bigger it gets, the scarier that gets.
Yep. Yeah.
You know, and it doesn't feel like a playground when you're playing with potentially my entire future.
Right.
You know? So I have a feeling that if I had the energy to do it again, could be more playground with it. Don't know if it works very well, because I'm sure there's some, there's some amount of fear that kind of helped drive us and kind of keep us on the ball.
Sure.
I don't have that energy to go do that. But like, if I did, it would feel a little more, oh yeah, it's okay.
Yeah.
But I just don't know anybody who's doing that at the start who feels that. Maybe there are people out there, but it wasn't me.
And you asked about stress. I kind of veered the question. I think a partnership, a healthy partnership is, I don't know how you build a business without it in my,
And you're talking about business partnership or are you talking about life partnership?
Both ways, actually. I was going to take business partnership first. Like there was many times where I'm at a peak stress moment and Max isn't. And so we kind of balance each other out. Other way around. And I can show up for him in those non-stress moments. And I can take on a little more in those moments and vice versa. And I think without that, it's just a lonely perch that burns you out way faster. Mm-hmm. So I think that's one. And then a second, I think partner wise, and Max would probably say the same. I have a partner and a wife that just didn't take it too serious as I did. She helped me realize this is not life and death. You know, when it came to stress, it was like, hey, do your best, work hard, but look, you're not curing the world of cancer here. Like we're building a software company that a lot of people like to work at and it's super cool and enticing, but don't put the weight of the world on your back. Like if this doesn't work, the world's going to end. Right. And I think that perspective, she comes from a very different background. She's a social worker by trade, and just being out of tech and startups completely when I walked home every day really helped the stress levels.
No doubt. I'm so glad Jess was not in tech.
Yeah.
You know, I'm so glad she didn't want to come home and talk about ARR. She didn't know what that was, you know, and it wasn't interesting to her and she didn't marry me for it, you know, for the company. I mean, we started dating when we were four people and there wasn't much there to marry for, you know, she didn't really understand what it even was. She was like, that's kind of cool that you're, you know, doing your own thing, but how that was going to work was, it's not why we got started dating. It's not why we kept dating. Right.
Yep.
So she never asked me how the quarter went. She knew she could feel it when the quarter wasn't going well, you know,
sure.
But she didn't need it to work and never once felt any pressure from her to do that right. Cause she'd remind me again and again, it's not why I married you. It's not why I love you. All the things that I love about you exist, whether you're doing Lessonly or not, which is what a relief, you know, what a relief. And then to the partnership internally, I don't know how anybody does it without that. Like, I just don't know how it's sustainable because it's not sustainable even with that. Right. Like it's hard even with that, you know,
sure.
I think there is something to be said for not only the partnership, but the ensemble, that if you get that right, that one person, like you said, can be in a crisis while four people are maybe not in a crisis, you know, but we have this culture of there's one person who's going out there and driving everybody forward. And there's one leader. And that's never how it was at Lessonly. It was different people were leading when they had different strengths to lead, you know, or different perspectives to lead. And it never bothered me. I was very grateful to be like, I don't know what to do here. There are things I've told you this, Matt, that when we went into Seismic that some of the folks at Seismic just naturally thought a CEO should know. You know, like, don't you know these metrics? Don't you know these numbers? And I was like, I've never known them. Yeah. I've never known them. Connor's always known them. And I've never known how to do the things that you're asking me how to do. And I don't think I ever will. You know, 10 years in, I don't think I ever will. It's just not where my head is. Sure. You know, ultimately, they kind of were like, okay, I'm starting to get it now. He does this stuff. You do that stuff. but it was, you know, odd. Yeah. And I think a lot of folks find it odd because I think the CEO a lot of times mentally tells themselves that they have to be able to do all of it. And I think I was just very lucky because that was never a condition for me. It was like, I don't know how I would do all of it, you know?
Totally.
Yeah. So I think that helped.
That's great. That's great that you had that. Go ahead, Nate.
Yeah. I'd like to ask about your guys' company culture and your employer brand. It seems to be, in my eyes, a superpower of Lessonly, right? And from two guys who started this super young, it's not like you had a ton of experience or a decade working at best places to work and wherever. How did you guys build that? And why, out of all the things, that be where you put stock into?
I don't know where else you'd put stock in. Like, and culture. Like, that, it's in my DNA to be like, the way people emotionally feel when they show up here is the most important thing. Like, our teammates' emotional state. And then, it ultimately bears out in a bunch of science, but like, you really don't need science to tell you that when somebody's comfortable, they're more open. You know, we constantly need people to point out potential opportunities, potential threats. If somebody is scared, they will do that a lot less. If somebody feels safe, they will do that a lot more. So now we have a bunch of people helping us build a better business instead of just us having to be the only eyes out there and everybody going, well, they're not asking for my opinion. They don't seem to want my opinion. So we'll just leave it to them to kind of, you know, see the opportunity and see the threats. We were like, hey, listen, we've never done this before. If you don't point out potential opportunities or threats, we're screwed. And we think you're smart. You know, you're not just a warm butt in a seat to fill up the office. You know, like, you are a working brain who has a lot to offer. So I think that ultimately is like a loving, a trusting environment of like, let's have fun together. And if you have a good idea, we want to hear it. And that creates a flywheel that starts spinning. People feeling comfortable. And that, guess what happens when people feel comfortable? They do point out the opportunities and threats, and then we can get on top of them. You know, somebody's like, hey, we've got this cultural issue over here, and I love this place so much, I'm going to bring it up before it gets out of hand.
Yeah.
How many times did that help save our freaking butts?
Oh, save.
It's because somebody who saw something, we were not around because the company kept getting bigger, right? We just weren't in those rooms and was like, I'm nervous about if this continues, what it's going to do to the business. If people are scared, they don't tell us that. So like, that's why first in the nucleus of everything is culture to me, because it determines everything else.
How much do you think that played into the acquisition?
How do you mean?
How much did Lessonly's employer brand, Lessonly's team play into the acquisition, the strategic multiple? And you don't need to disclose numbers or anything,
yeah, yeah.
But from a standpoint, huge successful outcome for Lessonly, all of your team members. And I love any context or color that you can provide there, dimension to what that experience was like, everyone winning together. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me that companies that have a strong brand, not just in the customer marketplace, but have a strong brand in the talent marketplace, tend to get bigger valuations, more interest in acquisition, have a bigger outcome. But I'm curious if that played in at all in the conversations with Lessonly and Seismic.
100%. Yeah. I mean, very few people in the software world are in a space where they don't have a litany of competitors these days. Like, there's very few original software companies that are just attacking some greenfield that no one else is looking at.
Right.
And product differentiation is fleeting, right? You get a little bit ahead and somebody copies you, and then you get a little bit behind and you got to catch up. So I think in a lot of ways, it's becoming more and more a dimension that is on, you know, when somebody, a strategic acquirer says, I want to go after this space, I think it's, and Seismic as much told us this, like, culture is one of the dimensions we look at. We look at the growth, we look at the metrics, we look at the product, and we look at the team and the culture. And, you know, one thing the head of corp dev at Seismic shared with us that I thought was pretty cool. He's like, look, when you're buying a company that's five people, the culture is the five people and probably the two founders or the three or four ensemble players that we've been talking about. Like, that's what you're buying. You're buying four people. That's the culture. But when you're 250 people, you're buying the culture, and the culture is absent the two of you. Like, whether you exist, these 250 teammates you have, this is what's going to make this acquisition. Culture shifts from being like personally focused on an individual to a collectivism that they're buying. So I thought that was pretty cool. And how much did that weigh into their decision about what product to partner with and what business to buy? I don't really know, but it seems like it was super important to them.
Yeah, they wanted, they said many times that they, of all the folks they looked at, they really wanted to work with us. Like, they enjoyed working with us. And yeah, two or three years before, Matt Lubbers, who was leading our partnerships, director of partnerships, he's linking arms with Seismic. And, you know, he's kind of, him and Ross Reinhart, lead engineer who builds the integration, they are kind of the two people who Seismic sees. And there was more than that, right? Like Josh Frankel, they see him too. But I think Ross for a long time was kind of spinning on that. Matt was spinning on it. Yeah. And that's the window into Lessonly. And these folks who they get exposed to, they're like, oh, the corp dev person talks to the people who work with them and says, we like working with them. And what a good sign, you know, for a big deal like this one is that people already like working together. There's no way it works otherwise, you know, like this, like don't bother, right. You know, if like this is going to be oil and water, and it wasn't. So that helped us in a really big way.
Talk to me a little bit more about what it was like talking to your team and letting them know, hey, Lessonly is graduating to this next level of growth with Seismic.
Yeah, I'm going to start by just saying one thing Connor and I talked about a lot was where do we think the business is going to go? And we said there's only three routes. One is we stay how we are right now and we pay dividends to shareholders over time. Like we grow the business and never sell it. We always thought that was a low likelihood because it was venture funded. You know, like venture funded businesses tend to either get acquired or go public.
Yep.
So then we talk about acquisition, which is the second one. And we said, this is the highest likelihood just statistically. Like if we hit a tailwind, we might be able to go public, but we have to be growing faster than we are right now and have to have a bigger market to kind of lean into if that's going to happen. And we'll probably have to be $100 to $200 million in revenue, and we're nowhere close to that, you know? So we said, we're probably going to get acquired just by definition of how things go. And the best companies in the world, people want to buy them, you know, like people hunt for the best companies in the world. So if we just do our job building a great business, naturally we probably get bought. So our teammates knew that. And we were very clear on that. We were never building the business to get acquired. We were trying to build a great business and knew that that's probably going to be the outcome, right? Ultimately, we always knew it would be fun for us to be like, oh, if that happens, that'd be really cool.
How did you communicate that to the team?
We said, I mean, all of this, like it's not, if we start building to be acquired, we probably won't get acquired, right?
Right.
If we build a business, like another paradox, right? If we build a business just to make a great company, we're probably very likely to get acquired, right? Yeah. And so I think that is maybe a confusing thing to know that we're probably going to get acquired, but then not build to get acquired. You know, you build to build a great business and then you might get acquired. So we communicated that again and again to the team. Yep. Every time they came on board, people would ask, where's this going? And we communicate those things. Mm-hmm. So then
one fun thing on that, yeah, say there was a week in the company where the two of us were probably in the opposite mindset. We were in the mindset of, well, we've been doing this a while. Maybe we should get serious about getting acquired, mm-hmm. like more purposefully. Mm-hmm. So we take this trip out to San Francisco. We've got all these meetings teed up with corp dev from every big tech company you can imagine. And we go for 3 days, meet all of them. Not one of them's interested in the slightest. We think we have, like, this is a peak. We feel like we're flying. Like, this is a great time. This was after Max described, like, 2019. We're coming off maybe the best year, best growth we've ever seen. We were just on no one's board. And what I mean by that is nobody had our category as a top priority. Right. It didn't matter how good of a business we built. And it was very sobering trip in that way. And I think that was one of the first that hit us in the face, because it was like, we got to just keep going. We just got to build a better business and let these cards shake out, because we're not going to force this to shake out. Anyway, sorry.
I was pretty much done, but to pile onto that, Connor bounced back from that, in my perspective, more quickly than I did. I was like defeated. And he was like, well, we got to go back and keep building the business, which is another reason it's so important to have an ensemble and a partnership, is like, if it would have just been me sitting there defeated and nobody else to be like, I'm going to keep going. I mean, he just carried it. And I was like sad, you know, like I was like, you know, kind of self-pity, you know, but like you were like, well, that didn't work how we wanted it to. So now I got to keep hitting the numbers. And so just again, really helps. But I want to pass it back to you. A reason I said the thing of like, hey, we might do dividends, we might do acquisition, we might do going public, is people knew that that was part of the plan, right? Yep. That one of those things was going to happen. And then we got to go tell them. So do you want to talk about the experience of going to tell people that, you know?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. So, you know, we've sold the business and we can share bits of that. I don't know how much you want to get into that, but once we get to the point where we've signed a definitive agreement, which was a 6 to 12 month saga. Mm-hmm. But once we got there, we're running on fumes because it's just been a full on 6 months. But we get to this point where the company doesn't know, the deal's signed, and we have like a few days before we're going to tell the whole company. And so we decided to pull you know, basically the first 20 employees, for all intensive purposes, aside and say, hey, here's what's happening. And honestly, it was the best week in the company in the 9 years, I think. There were many good weeks, but there were not as many meaningful interactions as those. Mm-hmm. It led to tears. It led to goosebumps. And it wasn't, you know, it obviously had a big financial implication for a lot of people. That was part of it. But I think the bigger part that almost everyone just, you could feel the pride in, I worked so hard at this for however long, 5, 6, 7 years. And this is something I'm super proud of. This outcome, I'm so proud of. And we did it. And at that time, we're burnt out. And I told Max, this is why you start a company. Mm-hmm. Like this week reminded me, that feeling reminded me. And I wasn't in that mindset. I was like relieved, like, oh, we got there. And it just re-energized me to think like, this is why people do this. This week is why people do this.
Yeah. And Connor's said that like, if somebody comes to him and starting a business, you know, urging them to give employees stock,
100%.
You know, like give them options, because that doesn't always happen. And it would have felt very different if we would have been holding stock.
Right.
And we would have hit that finish line and people would have just, and many people said this when we told them what happened, they said, we did it. Like those were the three words, the same ones he said, we did it. Like that was, and I was like, yes, precisely, you know, we did it. But then they said, this has never been easy. So many times people said, this job has never been easy. You know, like, which I hope people understand when we talk about having a culture that, you know, that we like, it had a lot of problems. It was never easy. You know, it would have been a lot harder if we had a culture we didn't like, you know, because that would have just been miserable. Yeah. But even having a culture we liked, those all have shadows, right? The brightest culture has a bright shadow or a big dark shadow. Yeah. And ours did too. But like people were like, it's never been easy. So this is so much more satisfying because I busted my ass, you know, again and again and again and again. And then yes, we freaking did it. You know, it was amazing. I get shivers just thinking about it. I mean, yeah, worth every day. I wouldn't ever do it again. Worth every day.
That's a great
Wouldn't
quote.
Do another 9 years to get there is what yeah. I mean, you know, yeah. But it was freaking worth it. Yes.
That's awesome. Well, I appreciate you sharing that story and keeping an eye on time. I could ask you another hour of questions about what's next with Seismic, but maybe you could just give me the elevator version of that. Lessonly and Seismic, what does that mean for Lessonly? What does that mean for the Midwest and the Unvalley? You know, Seismic's out of San Diego.
Yeah.
So very much an Unvalley company.
Yeah, 100%. And, you know, they've got offices around, you know, primarily San Diego, Boston, and then global offices as well. I would say one thing first, before we get to what it means, like Indianapolis was a huge advantage. You know, we talked about culture as an advantage. Indianapolis was an advantage in and of itself for the talent and for just the different way of thinking, I think. And, you know, the cost of doing business here would be the third. So they liked all of those things. So what it means for Indianapolis is investment roles that are not just Lessonly roles will get hired here. You know, and I think the Indianapolis footprint gets bigger for Seismic as it has at Salesforce and others, which is really cool. So I think where we're going together, it's a neat combination, and we've been in it 2 months, and it's been really unbelievable to see what a bigger force can help you do that you couldn't have done on your own. Yeah. You know, we had, as an example, been working for, I would call it 3 years. Max told you we closed a 7-figure deal, but we were trying to kind of move into the enterprise. That was our growth path. Mm-hmm. And we were rolling a ball slowly uphill on that journey. And in the first 2 months, it's been unbelievable to join forces with somebody who has enterprise in their DNA. Watch how fast that's accelerated. It's unbelievable. Deals we would have never dreamed of doing pop into the pipeline, and we've got a good process to do it, and they've got a team to do it, and they love the product, and they come together nice. So it's been, I'm making that sound super easy.
Much easier than it was. It was Sisyphus, man. Yeah. The rock fell back down every damn day, felt like, on the enterprise.
Yeah. So like,
it was hard.
The growth, I think you can just see it accelerating, and it's because the combination of these two things just made so much sense. And by that, I mean Seismic's really great at helping a seller deliver content to buyers. So helping a seller find their pitch decks and their case studies and their white papers and make sure those get delivered to the right prospect at the right time. That's kind of their core competency. With that, you need great sales reps to deliver great content. They need to know how to deliver the pitch deck, when to send the case study. That's where Lessonly comes in. So the two together, training, coaching, and content, is really the future we're building together. And I think, you know, the hope is eventually we get to be the next important sales investment after Salesforce, after the CRM, because sales enablement is a category that's going to keep growing. It's training, coaching, and content now. It's going to keep getting bigger.
Thank you guys for coming and sharing your story. And hopefully we can check in again in a year or two and hear how Seismic's continued to grow and scale. And
would love to. Let's schedule it for 2 hours. We need more time.
I love it.
Yeah, thanks, man. This is really fun. Thank you.
Thanks, guys.